The following is a North Carolina Baptist resource. For more, visit ncbaptist.org.
My name is Dan Collison, Metro Charlotte Strategy Coordinator with the State Convention. This is Bridges Out of Poverty, so we'll be talking about poverty and what we might be able to do to impact folks who are living in poverty with the gospel. That's really where we're headed with this. And so it is just it's a 45-minute segment that we have together. We're not going to be able to answer the world's problems in terms of solving poverty. But the point of what we're trying to do here today is to give an introduction for a direction that we as churches can move in, learn more about, and where some more resources lie in order for us to better understand what life is like for people living in poverty and how we as churches can more effectively help and build bridges of relationship across which we share the gospel. So before we open up, how many of you know someone who is living in poverty? You have an actual relationship with someone who's living in poverty? Okay. How many of you have a kind of a ministry that focuses on folks living in poverty to bring them relief or help or something like that? Okay, so good. And how many of you actually experienced poverty yourself as children or for a period of your life after that? How many of you have experienced poverty yourselves at some point in your life? Okay, yeah, good. What we've just described here, seen come to life around our table, is why we need to have sessions like this one. Because historically, Southern Baptist churches tend to be a couple of things. Now, I'm talking generalities. We do have variety and so forth, but we tend to be middle class. We tend to be white. We tend to be suburban. And so we kind of have looked at the world around us through a certain perspective that we've kind of become comfortable with, become used to. And one of the things we'll discover in this session today is sometimes we let our resources get in the way of how we're looking and trying to deal with somebody else. My role is as a strategy coordinator. Both Chuck and I are strategy coordinators with the convention. My work focuses on Metro Charlotte. Chuck's work focuses on the coastal area and the Greenville area, so eastern North Carolina. And what we've discovered in our charge to help churches better understand the pockets of lostness around them that need to be impacted with the gospel, what we've found is that large portions of those pockets of lostness, large portions of a great number of those pockets of lostness contain people living in poverty. And the churches that we have currently active in or near those lost pockets don't tend to have effective ministries in place in order to help people in poverty and then to see the gospel shared with them in a meaningful way as well. So we've been scratching our heads a lot about why that's happened, you know, what we can do to help reverse that and make some positive progress. We've had to take a really hard look in the mirror as a team, our strategic focus team, and then even we're beginning to take that look as a convention to say, you know, have we gotten in the way of the gospel ministry we're trying to share with people? We got one more seat for a table seat over on that side. Oh, there's one here as well, so that's good. After that, it's overflow seating, so you just made it in. And so that just gives you a little background to why we've come to this place. We're not, at least at this point for sure, as a convention, we're not saying this is the direction that all of our churches need to move in order to. This is one tool out of several that are available. And it makes a lot of sense for where we're at in most of our churches right now and trying to make a difference in that. So this is not a prescribed program that you're learning in 45 minutes. This is an overview of an introduction, of a framework of understanding that then equips us to actually interact more effectively with lost people who are in poverty. And I'll give you a shocking statistic for me in my work in Metro Charlotte. Of the 50 largest cities in the United States, Charlotte is on that list of the 50 cities, but it is dead last in terms of the opportunity for someone born into poverty to make it out of poverty in their lifetime. In the city limits of Charlotte, there is a 4.4% chance that someone born in poverty can escape poverty in their lifetime. That just breaks my heart. And for a number of reasons, we'll get into some of them. My work focuses on the pockets of lostness and in the Metro Charlotte area, of which we have 22 of the top 100 concentrations of lost people in the state of North Carolina. So there's a lot to do. About 28% of the landmass of Charlotte is contained within those geographic pockets of lostness. About 43% of the population of the city of Charlotte is in a pocket of lostness. So they're not the only lost people in Charlotte, but there are significant percentages of them in those areas. So lots of work to be done. We have 9 of the top 10 lost pockets statewide in the city limits of Charlotte, and 5 out of those 9 pockets have majority populations of people living below a livable wage standard. So it's incredible the amount of impact that when we're trying to make disciples, see disciples made in the name of Jesus in these areas of lostness, one of the really large issues that we cannot get around is how do we deal with the poor? And unfortunately, for a long, long time, our tendency may have been to think of the poor as a project that we can throw some resources at, and maybe they'll figure their way out of it. But if they don't, well, Jesus said the poor are always with us. and that's just it's an unfortunate perspective to have, because Jesus said a few other things about the poor too. And actually, the Bible is filled with statements about God's view of the poor. One of them is found right here in Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 10 and 11. And those verses say, "Give generously to them," that's the poor, "and do so without a grudging heart. Then because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed toward your fellow Israelites who are poor and needy in your land." Now, can somebody mention a thing or two of the Old Testament regulations that specifically related to how the Israelites were supposed to treat the poor, what they were supposed to do for them? You remember any?
Matthew 25:40.
Okay, which says,
"Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of my brethren, you did it to me."
Okay, yep. So thinking of the Old Testament and the regulations given to the Israelites, what were some of the practical things that God said we should do, that they should do?
There should be a year of Jubilee when the debts are forgiven.
That's right, yep. And so if a person had to put themselves into slavery, or indentured servitude, if you'd prefer that, in order to meet their debts, they would be freed in that year of Jubilee. That's right. What else?
Well, in the book of Ruth, we see the practical application of mm-hmm. gleaning in the fields, mm-hmm. where the field owners were to leave the corners of the fields for the poor.
That's right. Yep. They make your first pass, farmers, through the field, and whatever's ripe, pick it. You're going to leave whatever's not ripe. Don't go back and get that at a later time. Leave that for the poor. And the edges of the field were supposed to be left as well. So lots of practical things like that were given. This is kind of a summary statement for that. Give generously, do so without a grudging heart. And then at the end, I command you to be open-handed toward your fellow Israelites. That's a really hard thing for us to do in modern America, to be open-handed to the poor. Because it's really easy for us to say, well, I worked for this and you didn't. You know, why should I compromise my family's resources in order to help you, right? Jesus had a thing or two to say about that kind of an attitude. So Matthew chapter 19, verse 21, Jesus answered, if you want to be perfect, he's talking to what the man we refer to as the rich young ruler. If you want to be perfect, go sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come and follow me. This was in response to him coming to Jesus and saying, what do I need to do to get eternal life? And Jesus said, keep the law. And he's like, I've done all that since I was a child. I've kept it blamelessly. Okay, do one more thing. Go sell your stuff. And the stuff meant more than the kingdom of heaven meant to him. And then Mark chapter 12, verses 43 and 44, calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, truly I tell you, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth, but she out of her poverty, and put in everything, all she had to live on. I was in a church recently where a really big thing was made about someone. This was repeatedly over through the course of the message. A big deal was made about this individual who gave a very large sum of money to the church to help them through, a crisis period. Nothing was said about the people who gave their $5 or their $10 or their $20. But this person, Paul says a thing or two. I got to be careful. I'm going to start preaching. But Paul says a thing or two about that kind of thing in Corinthians, doesn't he? You know, we're not supposed to show preference to the rich. And Jesus here points out that she gave sacrificially out of her poverty. It was an easy thing for those rich folks to give a lot because they had way more. But she gave everything she had. So with those things in mind, we're going to consider this Bridges Out of Poverty perspective. I've given you this handout, set of handouts. There are some in here that we're either not cover it all or we're not going to spend much time on just because we are limited on time. We're going to hit several of them. It gives you a place to take notes. It gives you also a place to get more of a flavor for what we're talking about with this Bridges Out of Poverty framework. And then it also, I'll just point out now, the last two pages are additional resources that you can purchase through, it's called the AHA process, that's the name of the company, in order to learn more. If nothing else happens out of our time today, I would really like for you to jump on their website and purchase this book, Bridges Out of Poverty. Everything we're talking today comes out of this book and is just an initial reference to the work of Ruby Payne, Philip Duvall, and Terry Drewsy Smith. They are all Christians. This is not a Christian ministry. And one of the changes that we have to adopt or at least consider is one of the things we tend to do is to say, well, if there's that need, then either we're going to ignore it because we don't think we can do anything about it, or we got to make something from scratch ourselves in order to meet that need. And what we fail to realize is there are a whole lot of other people who are also trying to help out. And so one of the key roles that churches can play in communities of need is to be the ones that bring all of the different sectors together: education, government, business, nonprofits, social workers, to bring them all to a table, just like this one. It's kind of interesting. We're talking about poverty sitting around a board table. But, the church can be the facilitator to bring about a multifaceted approach, a sustainable, long-term, multifaceted approach to dealing with poverty that nobody else has had the capability to do to this point. We can do that. And we can do it from a Christian perspective, a Christian worldview, and giving the gospel message at the same time. That is the opportunity that's in front of us. It's just a matter of whether we'll step through it. And so here's just a little, we're going to start monkeying with some of our preconceived notions right now. So the real voyage of discovery consists not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes. It's what Jesus encouraged his disciples to stop and consider when he said, look to the fields. They're white to harvest, Pray to the Lord of the harvest to send laborers into the harvest. We need to have the eyes that see the harvest field, that see the work of God. Henry Blackaby encouraged us to do that in experiencing God. When he's telling us over and over and over again, look for the places that God is at work and join him there. And God is at work in some places that we don't necessarily expect him to be working. But what we find out is when we finally catch up to him, he's been already doing a lot. And that can be particularly true in a long-term sustainable ministry to those who are trapped in poverty. I'm going to throw a term out to you. It's there on your worksheet there, the back of that first page. It's due to social coherence. That's the educated term that they put on it, and the scholarly work that they've put into this. But listen to the way that's explained. Does a person have a sense of being linked to the mainstream of society, of being in the dominant subculture, of being in accord with society's values? Basically, does a person feel included or excluded? And one of the things you'll find as we're talking about these issues, it's amazing the way that you can look at it. How am I dealing with individuals in my own life? How am I dealing in the context of community? How are our churches interacting in community? And even what's life like inside of our own church? I was just talking to a young man, he's 24 years old. I was talking to him just 2 days ago. For the first time in his life, he went willingly to a church. He went on his own. He'd been rebelling against it ever since he was 16. He was taken as a young person, kind of grew up in church. He went to a large, seemingly very friendly church in the area. It was not a Baptist church, but he didn't stay for the service. And I asked him, you went through all the effort of getting ready and going. Why didn't you stay? He was like, I didn't feel comfortable because it all felt like they were giving me the stink eye. He's like, I don't know if it's the way I was dressed or if I wasn't done up well enough or whatever, but he says, I just didn't feel accepted, right? I mean, that's a very common story among people who are deathly afraid to actually surmount that obstacle of walking through our front door. And that's why relationships outside of church are so important to help people come in their faith. Second, can a person perceive society's messages as information rather than as noise? We all remember the Charlie Brown cartoons, and the voice of the teacher, whenever that would go, wah, 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 wah. That's what our gospel message sounds like to a lot of people because they just don't have the ability to hear what it is we're trying to say. The average person in a North Carolina Baptist church can read at an eighth grade level. And we're like, that seems kind of low. But you know what the standard is for the corrections department to determine how many beds in a jail that they need to have available down the road as they're planning? Reading at a third grade level. At a third grade level. That's where they see where the difference in somebody's life goes one way or the other. They stop hearing the message that's trying to be passed on to them. They can't accept it because they can't understand it. We can have the best gospel presentation we can come up with, but if it's not communicating to the person who's receiving it, it doesn't matter. Anybody familiar with the five love languages? I've heard about those, Well, if you're speaking in the love language of gifts and the other person is receiving the love language of speech, you can give all the gifts you want. What they want to hear is, I love you. And they want to hear it often, And then does a person have the resources to carry out plans? And finally, does a person get meaningful feedback from society? Do their messages make a difference? These are, we're really just glossing over these, but they're thought points for you to go back and think. It's like, wow, in our churches, in our communities, in the sharing the gospel message and trying to help people in poverty, what is it that we're saying? There's one pastor in the Charlotte area who, there's something in the news about poverty, and he decided to jump on his Facebook page and make a post that said the solution to poverty is just for you to get off your butt and go get a job. I'm like, wait a second here. First off, is there a livable wage job available for that person? Secondly, can they communicate in a way that will even get them in the door to be interviewed for that position? Thirdly, do they even know what they're supposed to wear to the interview that they need to have? And can they read the application that they've got to fill out, that multiple page thing? I mean, my sons, who are at least, you know, halfway through their college education, some of them a little further, they get frustrated filling out job applications, you know? If somebody's at a third grade or less reading level, how much more frustrating is it for them? Anyway, moving on. We only have 45 minutes. mental models. This is huge. It's life-changing if you'll think about it. You don't have this slide recorded, but the three circles there, one above the other on page 5 as it's numbered there, that's where we're headed. So a little bit of explanation. A mental model is simply an internal picture of how the world works. It's the mechanics that happen inside my brain when I'm looking at what's outside, how I perceive things, how I look at things, and how those things have an impact on me. Mental models exist below the level of awareness. It's the gut level reaction to whatever it is that's taken place. And so how you say what you're saying to me, the tone of your voice, the words that you're choosing to use, whether or not you're being condescending when you're saying it, if you're being sarcastic, those are all things that make a difference in the way that message is received. And the reception of that is below that person's awareness. They're not making a choice to say, I think I understand the content that they're saying, but they're being a bit of a jerk in saying it. So I'm just going to, you know, they're not thinking that. And even the police are up against this kind of situation all the time, right? Because they're in a situation where they are, in some cases, barking orders to a suspect, right? And what they're looking for is immediate compliance with their instructions. Because failure to have immediate compliance with instructions escalates the situation. And so, you know, they don't want that escalation, but they're ready for it. It's right there, right? Well, the person who's receiving those instructions is probably, especially if they're someone from poverty, is probably sick and tired of people barking orders at them. And their gut level reaction, their mind model just says, who do you think you are talking to me like that? And they may or may not actually say that, but that's what's going on inside. And so immediately, instead of a situation that can be resolved at a fairly low level, things get ratcheted up and emotions start to run very high. There's a lot of ways in which this all happens below the level of a person's awareness. It's part of their mental model. They determine how we act. They can help or interfere with learning. They can help our learning if we're aware of our own mental model and can set it aside long enough to properly understand somebody else's mental model. But if my mental model is in the way, I'm seeing everything about you through everything about me. And that's just not an effective way of connecting, right? So here we go with these mental models. The first one here is a mental model of poverty. Around the circle are things that that use up time in a person's life, things that where their time is used. And inside of the circle, the relationships thing there, that's the driving force of the mental model. We'll make some comparisons in a couple of minutes, but the four things across the top are the institutions of life, and we talk through how those institutions impact someone in this mental model. And then the things at the bottom, the list of businesses, are in a community that's living in this mental model. Those are the businesses that you're most likely to see in that area. So a mental model for poverty, and this is a mental model for poverty. It's a good generalization, but you know, individuals will see things a little differently. There are a lot of ways in which their time is used. Housing, health, mental health and chemical dependency, debt, safety, criminal justice, legal issues, family and friends, a lot of these things, you're thinking, well, you know, I may not be in poverty, but I deal with those things too. Hold on to that thought, okay? So even in terms of children, see what's there for children? You got a nice little playground, you know, that's sweet. And in terms of entertainment, that's important. Housing. What's a person in poverty thinking about housing? How, what kind of time is taken up in the life of someone living in poverty regarding housing? Well, it's probably a line of thinking about, I got a place now, but am I able to stay here? And in order to be able to stay here, what am I going to have to do in order to make that possible? Do I need to bring in somebody to live with me who can help me pay the rent? And what's that person going to do in terms of the dynamic of my family and even the safety of my family? What do I got to have to give that person in order to sweeten the pot so that they'll help me out with my rent instead of helping out somebody down the street? It's a very different situation than from what I face with my monthly mortgage, you know, just making sure I got money in my bank account to make sure that when it's that automatic debit taking place there, that that payment's covered and my insurance is escrowed in there. I don't have to worry about that. And, you know, like I'm still thinking about housing, but my mental model is very, very different from the mental model of somebody that's in poverty. So another thing I'll point out is, in terms of these organizations, how do those organizations relate to people who are living in poverty? The institutions themselves are the same. Kids, doesn't matter your socioeconomic background, hopefully they have the access to go to school. But what's the situation in school once they find it? Hi. And, you know, how are they reacting in that situation? And I love teachers. I know several teachers. They're good friends of mine. Teachers have a very rough job. They're overworked. They don't have the resources that they need in the class. They're not paid nearly enough for what they have to do and how they have to try to arrange things. So it's understandable that in a classroom setting, when, you know, Johnny upsets the class and causes distraction, sit down, you know. Okay, causes it again, sit down, be quiet. Causes it again, go to the principal's office. You know, that probably isn't communicating a message to Johnny that is the message that he needs. What, you know, what that's doing is feeding, when because of his mental model, how he's reacting at a gut level, what he's getting out of that is rejection. You know, so anyway, just by way of example. Jumping quickly here to the middle class, a lot of the things are the same, right? Childcare, that's still there. But what does childcare look like in middle class that might be different from childcare in poverty? Any suggestions?
Better schools,
that could sure be a part of it. Yep.
I would say unlicensed childcare facilities.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Stand in the living room of somebody else watching their TV all day.
That's right. Okay. Good. Anything else?
Grandma versus pay.
So, yep. Mm-hmm. A lot of family dependency for that, where that's possible, for sure. Yep. How about for children here, we got the nice little soccer ball there. And the poverty mental model, children was a playground. How does that strike you? It might be a little difference.
Playground. What? Possibly free, the soccer would be a paid activity.
That's right. Yeah. Middle class sports involves teams, involves traveling teams, involves status, involves competition. A lot of those things aren't available in an organized environment like a league or tournaments, that sort of thing, to be available for folks in poverty. Achievement is the driver for the middle class. So, but when you go to a party that's filled with middle-class people and you come up against somebody you don't know, what's the first question you ask them?
What do you do?
Oh, that's really interesting. You might ask a couple questions about what they do. That's great. How long have you been doing that? Great. Where'd you take your training? Where'd you go to school? Right? It's about achievement. It's about relationship back here. Now, that doesn't mean it's about healthy relationship. We're not making that judgment at this point. But it is about relationship because you know You need grandma to look after your kids, or you need that person that has the unlicensed daycare to look after. And so you got to do what you got to do to make sure that your kids are taken care of in a way that you don't get a call from your part-time job that you barely got in the first place, that you got to leave that job to go look after your kids, because you'll probably lose that job once you left, right? There's a lot of instability in poverty, and that's the huge lesson that we need to hear. It's instability at every level of resource. Yes, ma'am.
One of the things that I learned when I was a teacher, we had a workshop on teaching children who live in poverty. One of the things that they said was that children who live in poverty are not necessarily, children are almost considered property. Their parents want them there. They are their children.
Mm.
And they're not necessarily encouraged to get a higher education because then you leave.
Mm-hmm.
They want their family and they want their people there with them.
Yep, you're absolutely right. In fact, the rates of people who are from a poverty context that have made it through high school and even started an associate's level degree, the number of those people who have stopped that degree process within 2 or 3 credits of completion is astounding when you start looking at the numbers. And so you're like, well, why is that? And it's exactly because of that. It's like as soon as everybody else in the community finds out that, ooh, you graduated college, now you're all that, right? And it's not said in a good way. and then you end up leaving. So there's a resource lost to the community. Wealth is very, very different. It is the difference between middle class and wealth is at least as large as the difference between poverty and middle class. Now, in that verse we were looking at earlier about the rich young ruler, Jesus ends that in a conversation with his disciples by saying, it's hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. In fact, it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God than it is for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. That's pretty tough. But he doesn't say it's impossible, and he doesn't say don't try, right? So we need to share the gospel with wealthy people, but we need to understand them, and we also need to have them sitting at our collaborative table trying to help with poverty. Because here's the deal. When people in poverty interact with those institutions across the top, they have no power in those systems. None. It's the institutions acting upon the people. For people in middle class, it's people in middle class that run those institutions. And so you're talking the same language back and forth. And, you can, if you talk right and if you pay the right compliment and if you do the right things, you can get a little wiggle room. I've always said, I've had to confess this in front of people all over the time because I'm like, yes, I'm white. Did you guess that already? I'm white. And I know that as a white man, I benefit from white privilege. How do I know that? Because I've been in innumerable situations where, because I wasn't something else, I was able to say the right thing or do the right thing in order to get out of something or to get something that somebody else couldn't get in the exact same circumstances. So when I got pulled over by the police 3 weeks ago because one of my lights was out on my car, I was traveling at night, and I wasn't aware of it. When he pulled me over, and I'm like, yes, sir, can I help you? And he's like, license, registration, whatever. Yes, sir, here it is. I'm speaking middle-class language to an authority figure. And he was like, okay, just want to let you know that your light's out. And, you need to get that fixed at the earliest possible time. Okay, sir, have a good night. Be on your way. That looks very different for a lot of other people. A lot of other people. And it's not usually a very helpful thing. But it's middle-class people who run those organizations. It is wealthy people who set the policy that runs those institutions. Okay, so you have to have all three groups actually represented at the table. One of the most undervalued things about people who live in poverty is that they are incredible problem solvers. That's all they do all day long, is solve problems. And it's got to be done on the fly a lot of times. And yet we think that we can come in as the middle class and say, let me fix your problems for you. And they're like, You got no clue about what it means to fix my problems. They don't need us to tell them what to do. They need us to help them figure out a path to do what they already know they need to do in a lot of cases. Sometimes there needs to be some change in there, but a lot of times they've already got that important resource of problem solving. Tyranny of the moment is huge in poverty, and we need to understand that better. The tyranny of the moment rules the life of people living in poverty. Poverty and all its related concerns require so much mental energy that the poor have less remaining brain power to devote to other areas of life. Please understand that does not mean they're stupid. It's not what that's saying. It's not, they're not less smart. Their IQs don't need to be lower. You know, it's not saying that. But there's only so much that our brains can do in a certain period of time. You know that from being in this convention. By this time in these 2 days, it's like overload. You know, we use that information overload. We use that term. It's the same thing for somebody living in poverty. By the time the day ends, whenever that happens, it's like there's just nothing left to give. And so there's two things that become really, really important in their lives. One is their time horizon, how far into the future they can project a reality for them, their time horizon. People in middle class tend to think 2 to 4 years in advance. So, you know, when my kid becomes a freshman in high school, yeah, I'm thinking about their years in high school, but I'm also thinking about, you know, what do you want to do with the rest of your life so we can get started on what college you need to go to and start getting some scholarship money lined up for that. And years before that, a lot of middle class people already have the child education fund that they've been sacking away money in for a long time, right? That's a time horizon that extends out years into the future. People in wealth, their time horizon is in terms of generations. They're thinking about legacy. They're thinking about influence. They're thinking about relationships that can be, you know, that can help each other over a long haul. They're not thinking about tomorrow. They hire people to think about tomorrow. You know, they're not worried about that at all. But people in poverty, a lot of time, people who are really living in poverty, the national poverty standard is $24,000 annually for a family of four. Wow. I mean, that's the $24,000 for a family of four. That's the federal poverty level. So
I don't think a lot of people understand the distance between poverty and middle class that you mentioned earlier.
Even the distance between poverty and livable wage. Livable wage in North Carolina is $11 an hour for 60 hours of work completed a week. That's a full-time job and a part-time job either held by one person in the household or two.
There was one statistic, if I can add this, is when you have a criminal record, the ceiling is capped.
Oh, absolutely. Sure it is.
In North Carolina, there was a report back in 2013, I think there was like 1.6 million with criminal records. And this is when today you can't get a job. 92% of the employers does criminal background checks. And if you have a criminal record, it's about 50% chance you will not be called back for a second year.
Oh, sure. Yep, absolutely.
So you dug yourself in a hole, and it's almost impossible to get out.
Yep, and dug yourself in a hole, or that hole has been dug for you. Yeah,
exactly.
Definitely. Yep, just a couple more thoughts on the tyranny of the moment. The need to act overwhelms any willingness people have to learn. Something has to be done. It's the urgency of it. I got to do this. I don't care if it's the best thing for 5 or 10 years down the road. I need something to work now, right? This is key. The healthier you are psychologically, or the less you may seem to need to change, the more you can change. That's paradigm shifting right there. The healthier you are psychologically, or the less you may seem to need change, the more you can change. Which means for those who have, who are compromised in some way psychologically, the change that they need is either harder or completely out of reach.
Or it becomes self-medicated.
Mm-hmm.
And then they end up putting what they have into that.
Absolutely. We're going to move on. A couple pages later there, you have causes of poverty. And across the spectrum of research, there's basically four different sections. Which page is that on? There it is. Number nine. Yes, thank you. There's basically four different segments, so different ways that different groups of people approach the issue of poverty and have done research on it. Because we need to understand that a lot of times when people do research, they're starting with a set of preconceived notions and they're drilling down into those preconceived notions. It tends to be pretty narrow focused. There's not a lot that's spectrum wide. And so one of the things that Ruby Payne and Phil Duvall have done is to analyze across the spectrum of the research that's available and try to see what similarities emerge. And it's really pretty interesting. So there's these four different categories: that poverty is the result of individual behaviors and circumstances, that poverty is a result of community conditions, that poverty is a result of exploitation, or that poverty is a result of political or economic structures. And so the kind of fascinating thing is, if you want to make a line right here, this tends to be the Republican lens toward poverty, and this tends to be the Democratic lens approach toward poverty. And what we've done, what we've seen happen in our culture over the last couple of decades is the polarization of those views. So instead of coming together with varying opinions and talking through what we've all found in the research, we say, oh no, you're wrong, we're right, and we keep lobbing the bombs back and forth. And we go for solutions that are only partially informed, and we railroad that through the structures for implementation by the middle class upon those living in poverty. So in some cases, the topics that are investigated are the same. So take these first couple, racism and discrimination issues. But then, say, the individual behaviors and circumstances, you start looking at bad loans, credit card debt, lack of savings, dropping out, lack of education, job loss, teen pregnancies, all of that. Those things all certainly contribute toward poverty. But so also do these. Bursting bubbles, free trade agreements, lack of wealth-creating mechanisms, stagnant wages, insecure pensions, deindustrialization, globalization. You know, they just as much contribute toward people living in poverty as those individual things. And it's got to be considered together. We got to take some from all four silos instead of cherry picking which one of those categories we want to hear the most from. These key points talks about this workshop focuses on economic environments. The workshop that's being talked about is I've already encouraged you. If the one thing you do leaving here is to purchase this book from the AHA process, that would be a very, very helpful first step. The next step, if you choose to continue, is to have a certified trainer come and help your organization, your church, a group of churches. You'll be led through a 1 or 2 day an interactive seminar process that will unpack these issues and help you apply them much more completely in your specific area. So when it's talking about a workshop, that's what that workshop is talking about. Now, as it happens, I'm a certified trainer, the only one available in the convention right now, but I'm a certified trainer for Bridges Out of Poverty for our affiliated churches. So if you wanted to pursue that, we have a mechanism in place where that's possible. And it would be because I'm accredited for the Baptist State Convention of North Carolina, there's no charge for me to come to do that. It would just be if you wanted to serve food to people for lunch or snacks, or if there was a charge for the place that you wanted to hold it, if it wasn't going to be in your church or whatever, those are additional costs. And of course, the cost of the book would be carried by those who comes, $25, by the way. But, there wouldn't be any additional cost for the speaker. But that's the focus. The workshop focuses on economic environments. Economic class is relative. It's a continuous line, not a clear-cut distinction. We've talked about it as if it's a clear-cut distinction, but it's actually much more of a of a spectrum. And I think I put that... nope, that one's not in here. But it starts on the left side with left side for you, generational poverty, then situational poverty. Middle class would be next, and then there's new money and old money for wealth, right? So you got this progression. And the way the research kind of boils out is it takes about three generations to get from generational poverty into middle class. This is not a, it's not a light switch kind of thing. In fact, Ruby Payne actually says that unless you're prepared to give the next 20 years of your life toward making a difference for the people living in poverty in your area, don't bother starting. Because it's a serious, serious thing, and it's got to be long term. It's got to be sustainable. But you know, it's not just about the accumulation of resources, financial resources. It's about a bunch more. And I'm just going to jump ahead. You got all this other content here. I'm going to finish with this last slide. Because when we talk about resourcing people, when we talk about, you know, we usually see that in terms of dollars and cents. And whether that's represented by giving away free clothes, free food, free lodging, free medical dental clinics, or handouts of cash for bus rides or whatever like that, we tend to think of it in financial terms. There are so many more categories of resources in a person's life than just money. Case in point, we've all heard about people who've won the lottery. The statistic is that most people who win the lottery are in worse financial condition 5 years after they won the lottery than they were before they won the lottery. Throwing money into a broken system breaks the system further. So it's not just a matter of, okay, we're going to take up a special offering and we're going to divide it up among the poor people that we know and all right, go, you know, your life's all better now. No, there's these eight different types of resources that are critically important in every person's life. And it's a matter of being able to evaluate how much of that resource exists. Ruby Payne actually says, and rightfully so, I think, that someone can be very well off financially, but have low levels of resource in three or four of these other areas, and they can be living in poverty even though they have a lot of money. They're living from a poverty mindset that we were talking about before, that mind map. So we got financial, which is obvious. There's emotional, just being able to choose and control emotional responses, particularly to negative situations. Road rage it's the stupidest thing ever. If you really stop and think about it, it's like the very thing that somebody gets mad at another driver for, they themselves do 5 minutes later. And that's supposed to be okay. Oh, sorry. You know? But it's crazy. We don't have margin anymore between an event that takes place and what our emotional response is to it. That's almost evaporated completely in our culture. Mental resources. Again, it's not a level of IQ. It is talking about just how much mental capacity do I have to give to something? How does my experience in life enable me to think through issues critically? Spiritual resources in here. Believing in divine purpose and guidance, Ruby Payne says, is incredibly important in somebody's ability to live well. I tend to agree with her, wouldn't you? Yeah, good. All right. Physical resources, health and mobility are critically important issues there too. Support systems, friends and family, backup resources available and so forth. Relationships and role models are critically important, and knowledge of hidden rules. Here's how we apply these. You can do it all in your hand. You got five fingers. You can talk about this part of your hand being one resource, and you talk about the middle of your hand being another, and then your wrist, because that sort of works there too. So you can see how it's been labeled there. So this, you got support systems, role models coming right there on that sort of strong part of your hand. Your middle finger, financial resources. Ring finger, mental resources, emotional and the middle finger, spiritual on the pointer, physical on the thumb. Hidden rules is really important, but we don't have time. And then your bridging and bonding resources in the middle. If you evaluate your level of resources in each of those areas, You know, some of them will be a half finger, you know, or full finger. Maybe we have them. But the key thing is, I mentioned at the beginning, a lot of times when we have our resources, we put them in front of our face and we try to evaluate other people's existence based on what our resources are. And, I mean, I got a graduate level education. A lot of times I just assume that everybody else does too, you know. Well, they don't. You know, there's a lot of people who just don't think that same way. And that's great. That's fine. But I got to move my resources out of the way so that I can actually engage fully with somebody else. Thank you for your time and attention. I know that was really drinking out of a fire hydrant there for a few minutes, but I hope it gave you enough to whet your appetite for more. And so, you know, I don't get anything from the buying Bridges Out of Poverty books. I just wish you'd do that. And if I can help by coming alongside and doing a workshop, a 1 or 2 day workshop with your church, I'm happy to do that too. Come talk to me. If you take a second to fill out those evaluations and leave them behind, that would be awesome. Thank you very much.